If you're feeling a little cabin feverish, take a little winter road trip to Ottawa, Illinois, a fun, friendly, charming destination with boutique shops, small-town coffee shops, award-winning locally brewed beer, and all kinds of excellent casual and fine dining. Log on to visitottawail.com today.
Today is Wednesday. It's January 29th. It's 2:37 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams, and thanks for finding the Mincing Rascals podcast. Share us with your friends. This is the podcast for people who care about Chicago. Listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Burr from the Illinois Policy Institute and co-founder of Iron Light, a marketing agency working to change the world. You can check out my book, The New Chicago Way, Lessons from Other Big Cities.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter columnist, now writing the Chicago History Substack, Roseland, Chicago, 1972.
I'm Brandon Pope, host of WCIU and the holder of the most famous beard in the city of Chicago.
Oh, did you win the award this year?
We don't know yet, but I have an inkling that I did. I really feel it this year. I really do.
Oh, now, wait a minute. That's not, the results have been leaked. It's that you're just feeling it. Is that it, Brandon?
You know, it's the ambiance, the aura, you know?
Who is it that does this? Is it Time Out or who does it?
Chicago Reader.
The Chicago Reader asked its readers who has the best beard in the city.
You were not stuffing the ballot box, so to speak. You just sounded awfully confident.
Yes. Austin, your thoughts, go.
My thoughts were, you know what's funny is I remember when I went to go see Pope at the WCIU studios, and it makes me think of another famous beard. And it was a guy who maybe even had a poster in the studio. He was definitely on TV. Another Chicago legend, but I don't know if he's eligible because I think he's a suburbanite. Sven Gulli.
Oh. Wow.
I think it counts as a beard, right? He has mustache and beard. I mean, it's a completely different category. I think it would be unfair to...
I don't think it's a real one either.
I can confirm it's fake. I know the real Sven Gulli.
You know, we're looking at each other on a Zoom screen right now, on our radio listeners and our podcast listeners aren't. But the beard that Brandon grows, it's full on, ear to ear, down to the chin. But the landing spot below his lower lip and his upper lip is kind of clear. Now, is that just the way it grows, or are you shaving it for effect that way?
What a breakdown. But I do some grooming of it, of course. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, it should
the
win.
Best I can do for TV, you know, I can let it grow out, but it gets a little whiskery.
Oh, that's right. You're a TV personality too. So then do you get counseled on that from the producer or program director?
I get some messages if it gets a little unruly. So there is a limit.
So a couple of hours ago, and cover me on this, guys, I'm just going to do the best I can. The federal government rescinded that funding freeze to scores of agencies across the country. The halt lasted not 24 hours. Rather than await a judgment in the courts, the Office of Management and Budget, in a single sentence this afternoon, said the plan has stopped. And you could have assumed that that trial balloon popped and the freezing of funds for Head Start and Medicaid and education was over. But moments ago, and this is why we record the Mincing Rascals, I give the date and time, because moments ago, Carolyn Leavitt, the White House press secretary, tweeted that this is not a recession of the federal funding freeze. It is simply a recession of the OMB memo about that. Why, she writes, to end any confusion created by the court's injunction. You recall a Washington, D.C. judge has paused the implementation of the order until the first of next month. The Leavitt tweet continues, the president's executive orders on federal funding remain in full force and effect and will be rigorously implemented. So we've had this statement that we're going to freeze funding until people prove their bona fides for the administration on a whole host of factors. And if they're okay, then Donald Trump is going to continue to release the money. That was the idea. But then you get this statement from the OMB saying that we have rescinded that. And then the White House comes back and says, we've rescinded the OMB memo, but we are not rescinding the president's order, which did what we started out with here. The New York Times says the administration is expected to find ways to put Trump's wishes into practice. those wishes being to ask federal agencies to purge themselves of any woke or Marxist or green ideologies in order to continue to get their funding. One last thing. The court order then is still in effect. That is freezing it temporarily, even the president's order. So Illinois Medicaid, for instance, is still up and running for now. Whew. That's all I got. That's what I think is happening.
It's so hard to tell, right? Part of the intention definitely appears to be to sow chaos, as well as the fact that they obviously have been just throwing this stuff out as fast as they can and not doing it in any kind of well-thought-out manner. So maybe I'm wrong, but I think what I got out of the New York Times update is that the freeze, the memo from the OMB has been definitely taken off the table.
Right.
But his directive to basically get rid of DEI sort of programming.
Right, right. Is still in place.
That just kind of vague sort of thing is still there.
Whatever that means, but it is that executive order that a court has put a pause on, right? So there's an injunction until sometime next week. Presumably, those funds will still flow pending a court order or a judgment on this.
It's going to come down to, I think, arguments around this power of impoundment. This is one of those weeks where everybody in the country like learns a new term about what the federal government does. And impoundment is like one of the words of the week. And the idea of impoundment is, can the president freeze funding that's basically been authorized by Congress? Congress is supposed to have the power of the purse. Can the president just go in and say, no, this money is not going out the door? In my opinion, impoundment is one of those things like nuking the filibuster, where when your person's in power, it seems like the greatest idea.
Right, right.
And then when the other person is in power, it's, you know, it's really horrible, which means it's a power that shouldn't be used. And I think we saw two really, really a good example and contrast this week in terms of one of, I think, something that the Trump administration would see as their mandate, which is to slow the growth of government spending to help on inflation. And one example was this, which was just complete chaos, confusion, frustration, cruelty. Even if you say, you know, you're going to really cut spending and go hard at it, the way to do that would not be to, you know, have states be locked out of a portal where they're getting their matching funds for things on a random day with no notice. You would actually want to go through those things and present the case to the American people. That was just so horribly done and horribly rolled out. I would contrast that with something like the announcement on buyout offers for federal employees.
You suggested that weeks ago.
I want to say, it may have been Musk or some, one of these Doge people, I think a long time ago suggested something like this. And I think it's this has happened at state and local governments. I think actually Daley, the second Mayor Daley, even did this in the late 2000s in the city of Chicago. And I think it's a really good idea and is able to slow the growth of spending without, even from a communications perspective, being seen as someone who's just taken away people's jobs and firing everybody left and right because it's voluntary. So I think for everyone's sake, it would be better if the Trump administration pursues that angle of reducing the growth of spending versus just the extraordinary chaos of what you saw.
I know somebody that got that email and they certainly weren't anticipating. It popped up in their work inbox and they open it up and it says, click here to quit and we'll give you 8 months pay. And he was like, you know how sometimes you hover over a thing and you accidentally hit a button? You ever DocuSign something wrong? They're like, whoa!
Well, there's some confusion out there, too, about whether that buyout is really a buyout or if it's really you're working from home for 8 months or if it's a trick. If you hit it and you opt out and there's really nothing promising you a buyout at all. And a lot of that's kind of built off suspicion and doubts around Elon Musk and how he handled the Twitter situation. Mm-hmm. And that didn't go down too well. But yeah, overall, I mean, just seeing all this play out, it's not shocking. This is exactly what Donald Trump ran on. This is why he won. This is what people said they wanted. And we saw it in action. And as Kate mentioned, the chaos here, it's intentional. This is not ineptitude on the Trump administration's part. This is strategy. Every executive order, every funding freeze, the shakeups with staffing, the gutting of agencies, everything. It's all built to dismantle democratic norms. It's built to throw things at the wall to see if they stick, push the bounds of what presidential and White House power, executive authority actually is, leave people distracted, confused, and eventually get people to tune out with the barrage of information coming at them. It's already happening. And that is how you get away with doing things that you shouldn't be doing.
But I think Matt Gaetz was an example of something they knew they were going to do just to distract and confuse or test the limits. I think the Gulf of Mexico renaming is something that is a distraction more than an attraction. But I wasn't so sure about this. And I know this might be a trial balloon of sorts, but I thought Trump 2.0 was going to be a little cleaner, you know, a little more surgical. This looks like a lack of communication between OMB and the White House. I can't imagine that they wanted this sort of confusion to roll out. Maybe I'm wrong. I hear you, Brandon, but it just seems to me like it's a forced error on their part.
I would somewhat agree, but you got to remember, I mean, for all the difference in personnel that you do see from Trump 1.0 versus 2.0 in terms of the public facing, right? You have these, David Sachs on the crypto and AI side, and you got like an Elon Musk and, you know, these sort of like titans of industry who are coming onto the team Trump. You still have people, you know, kind of like a Stephen Miller from Trump 1.0 land where they want to go in and just break some stuff. And, I think there's been a lot of discussion about like, well, is this, you know, malice or incompetence or both? And it's like, well, incompetence at the limit is kind of indistinguishable from malice. So when you see something like this happen, I think there's definitely, and we'll see more reporting about this as we've, I think, elucidated here, like the last 48 hours, it's very, very hard to parse what is an affirmative decision and what's a consequence of just like, oh man, someone unplugged the wrong computer or, you know, this agency interpreted something completely different than another agency. So we can't even access this website, you know, like that kind of stuff. I just think I would credit that a little bit more to incompetence because say your goal really was to cut spending. This would be the most ham-handed, you know, silly way to do it possible because it's not like you're going to bring it down to zero. It's not like you're really catching anything. And in fact, you're creating all these other problems. So I don't even think it's necessarily going to be for people who want to cut the spending. That's not the move you would make.
I think that's definitely a bit of both, because I don't even think the Trump people would have purposely tried to shut down Medicare payments, even Trump.
You mean Medicaid?
I meant both, because there was a problem with both. Even they, I don't think, would want to screw around with enough of even their own base to...
Sure. A lot of Trumpers get Medicaid, for crying out loud.
Right, right. Exactly. So, you know, clearly they're throwing these orders out right and left, and they don't have enough competent people to figure out how these things are actually implemented. Somebody, as Austin says, throws the wrong switch, and for a little while, the states can't access certain databases until it gets brought to their attention, and then they walk it back.
Well, Brandon, as signaling goes, it's on page, right? I mean, it is saying if you're woke, if you're LGBTQ or DEI friendly, if you're green friendly, these are the things that they're trying to minimize or stamp out. Even if this doesn't hold the legal muster, it's still going to tell people here's where we are.
I could be wrong here completely, but I really do think every single bit of this is intentional because, one, the people that Trump has appointed as his czars over this, what they call Doge, Elon Musk, and formerly Vivek Ramaswamy.
Yeah, he gone.
Vivek in particular, he said this very thing when he was campaigning. Freeze all federal spending. That's what he said to do. And he was given powerful position. He's not there anymore, but I would think there's other people aligned with him on that. And if Trump's going to put him in power, that's part of the strategy there. The other part of this too, and we got to look at the pattern of Trump. Trump ends something, people fall into chaos. He brings it back. He claims he's the savior. And in our fractured media environment where people don't read news anymore, they get all their info from TikTok and X and their biased sources, what's going to last is, oh, Trump brought Medicaid back.
Well, we
laugh at it, but that's how it works. That's how the TikTok thing worked, and I think that's what he's going for here, too.
Oh, yeah, right, saving TikTok. Well, say you were in charge of early childhood education, a Head Start, and you had some policies that tried to hire minorities or LGBTQ plus people. I presume those are the things that they're trying to make sure they purge from any agencies that receive federal funds. So I wonder how this information gets filtered back to the White House or the Office of Management and Budget to then score that and then release or not release funds. You know what I mean? I mean, we know that they're against Marxism and the Green New Deal, wokeism. I wonder how it functions. What will they do with this information? They're going to prorate it? They're going to completely cut funding? I wonder what the mechanism will be by which they actually do something with this executive order.
By their definition, DEI is illegal and discriminatory, as was the Lyndon B. Johnson Civil Rights Act.
Okay, so then maybe until you then write that requirement or that thing out of your workplace, so now Head Start no longer has that inclusive language in its hiring, then the money will be released, but we got to run it through this filter. Is that what you're telling me, Brandon?
That's what it sounds like they're trying to do. It's everything's got to be through the new filter. And on this DEI thing, I think it's important to say this. All this talk about merit and things being merit-based, that was the whole point of DEI. The whole point of a diversity, equity, and inclusion program is to make sure that you're opening the field up to other people who then get in off of their merit. What was happening before DEI was we were passing around jobs to the same straight white men, usually, and not considering anybody else who may be more qualified for those positions. DEI opened the field to not just minorities. We're talking about women. We're talking about disabled people. We're talking about veterans.
Okay.
That is what diversity, equity, inclusion is. And so Trump deciding that we're going to prioritize merit, it's the complete opposite of what he's doing here.
They would argue that. They say that we're going to be equitable, not equal. We're not going to make sure that we demographically represent a community or a population and make it equal. We're going to make it equitable. If you are qualified, then you get the job, regardless of your the color of your skin, your religion, your orientation. But
how it was in the 60s, but there was discrimination and all kinds of barriers that made it so that's not what happened. They're trusting people to make good, friendly,
merit-based decisions. And you don't think that the playing field is sufficiently level now that DEI is no longer necessary?
Compare who the Biden defense secretary was versus the current. Pete Hegseth's resume versus Lloyd Austin. And that tells you everything about merit. there's a clear divide here. On what they define as merit. The merit seems to be you're an attractive looking white guy on TV.
Yeah, I think in terms of the federal funding, the place where that comes to mind, which this is kind of the only example I can think of where you have government institutions having some real legal liability in terms of their policies in this area would be the post Supreme Court ruling with higher education on race-based admissions or, you know, race-inclusive admissions or how, I don't know, I'm not quite sure how you'd want to phrase it. But, you know, for example, you would have a school like, and this isn't taxpayer funded, but this is the example I always think of, like a Harvard, where essentially, you know, you're adding a new score to, you know, your merit system of scoring students who are applying, all these hundreds of thousands of students are applying. And, oh, guess what? Just so happens that like all the Asian kids get really low scores on the like, you know, made up new index that we did, because otherwise all these Asian American kids are kicking everybody's ass on standardized testing. And then you have, you know, rightfully so, class action lawsuits against that institution saying this is racial discrimination. This is just like Jewish students were, you know, in the 20s, 30s and 40s at this place. And what makes me so frustrated about that issue in particular is that it hides the ball from things that actually were harming merit to an extraordinary degree, which are things like legacy admissions, which still do exist at places like Harvard and even at some taxpayer-funded institutions. So I do see that you could have a middle ground in terms of like higher education where you don't really want federal – if you're federal money flowing to a institution of higher education and they have some of those policies that are going to be challenged in court and cost people a lot of money, I think you even perhaps have a responsibility to freeze or assess or do something with those funds until you get that in order, because it's a big liability and it is unfair. But to do this entire thing, which, you know, every single dollar of federal spending, nothing's moving until there's like an affirmative, you know, something that like gates it out. It's just going to be a total mess. And I don't think you're even going to achieve your ends of fixing this stuff. It's just going to be chaos.
I mean, obviously, like anything else, there are going to be good and effective DEI programs and not so good and not effective DEI programs. And rather than actually studying and seeing what they actually have going on in the federal government, they just throw out this blanket thing.
And the thing is, the thing some people might not realize is, like, if you I've been in organizational situations where we have to, for example, oh, man, the plan's coming in really low at the end of the year. Anything anyone wants to spend on paperclips, you got to go through like three layers to get that done.
Yeah,
right. That's normal. But the difference between that and what the federal government's doing is the organizations depending on these grants, it's not like they get like the big chunk of money at the beginning of the year. They're often getting their payments in like, you know, 2 weeks at a time. And even just a few days sinks, if they can't get that cash flow, a few days just sinks it entirely and it can't get back up. So it's very destructive to go about it in this way.
Yeah, I heard about a Head Start program in Michigan, somebody that owned 30, 40 Head Start schools, and they've got payroll to meet. And they canceled school yesterday or today because they said, we don't want to be on the hook for services that we can't pay for, so no Head Start. And you could see people doing that indefinitely until they're guaranteed that the money is going to come in on a sort of real-time basis. More on the mincing rascals after a quick message from our friends in Ottawa. If you're feeling a little cabin feverish, take a little winter road trip to Ottawa, Illinois. It's the fun, friendly, charming destination with the boutique stores and the small town coffee shops and the award-winning locally brewed beer and all kinds of excellent casual and fine dining. Settle down and snuggle up in one of Ottawa's nearly 400 rooms with hotels, private rentals, cottages, B&Bs. Start making memories in Ottawa. It's the middle of everywhere. Log on to visitottawail.com. Brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. Chicagoland is in the national news. The office of Southside Dalton Mayor Tiffany Henyard, labeled on our News Nation as America's worst mayor, was investigated by former Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot. Lightfoot's report detailed excessive and unaccounted-for spending totaling $750,000. And our current mayor, Brandon Johnson's office, was investigated by the city's inspector general for harboring gifts. Hey, what's in that gift room at City Hall? After some skullduggery and FOIA requests, we hear that there's whiskey and Kate Spade bags in size 14 shoes in there. So who gave them and why and to what use are these going to be put? Crickets from the mayor's office. But most importantly, of course, in Chicago, there is the news of ICE agents combing the city and suburbs. Since we last met nationwide, a few thousand migrants have been arrested. NBC says today 52% of them for criminal reasons. So maybe 48% of the arrestees were for non-documentation or what Tom Homan described as collateral damage. The big question for our listeners, guys, on the radio was, is being without proper documentation sufficiently criminal to merit getting deported? Tom Homan, who braved our dangerous city streets last week with Dr. Phil and his live stream TV crew, said that is the very fact that you're here without documentation. You didn't rob a bank. You don't have a speeding ticket. But you are here without proper documentation, and therefore you are a criminal. Today, his office reiterated that persons here illegally are criminals and subject to deportation.
What answers did you get? What percentage of opinions did you get from the listeners, John? I'm curious.
I was surprised. You know, it's non-scientific. It's a click survey, but it usually is pretty close to more legitimate surveys. And 75% said they don't think those people should be deported because some of them have them cleaning their house next week or they're going to stay in a hotel. I don't know what the motivation was. I'm with them. If you've been living here for decades and you haven't done anything wrong, just as a practical matter, I think this was the point you made last week, Austin. What are you going to do about it?
Yeah, it's similar to me. The people, and this is like a kind of funny inconsistency on the right. I think the argument of just take away everybody's guns is bad for the same reason of, you know, deport all the illegal immigrants. And it's the state apparatus that it would take to do both of those things is so scary and would overstep civil rights in such an extraordinary way, especially among the most disadvantaged people, that no end would justify the means of doing that. And I think as a practical matter, if you're in the country and you're not supposed to be here, I believe that is a civil infraction, not a criminal infraction. So it is a civil offense. I mean, you're breaking the law. You're not supposed to be here. But in terms of creating a federal government apparatus that can do that for the amount of people who are here, I think it's just crazy. And I do think there's bipartisan agreement. And you've seen, you know, over the last 20 years, I think actually the presidents have been consistent on this, where if you commit a crime and you're here illegally, you should expect to be deported. And Larry Snelling and Brandon Johnson had a press conference, I think, was that Tuesday morning, maybe even Monday morning, And Snelling had said he was told there were around 100 people who had been arrested by ICE in the Chicagoland area, and it wasn't clear how many of those people had criminal convictions. And I was really disappointed with the amount, the level of communication that is required on those things to not have collateral damage. You know, there's two types of collateral damage: people who are arrested, who, you know, just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. There's also collateral damage of, like, I own a plant store in Pilsen and nobody's coming into my store and I'm going to have to close in 3 months because everybody's freaking out and won't go outside of their house. That's collateral damage too, and can be solved if you say, yeah, hey, all 100 of these people had, you know, sexual offenses or something. That's not that hard to do. The federal government has that information and they should be releasing it. And that would, I think, actually serve to quell fear if they did that.
And again, they may be doing that on purpose, unfortunately. It makes absolutely no sense, because although I haven't heard anyone specify an actual number of the criminals that they believe are here
in Chicago,
undocumented here or nationwide, mm-hmm. I haven't heard an actual number. You know, we have X number of undocumented immigrants and X number we believe, you know, we have on our books as needing to be deported. But they've made it clear that there's a lot of them, and it will take a lot of work to find them. And so why are they wasting time with apparently almost 50% of the people they've picked up in Chicago not falling underneath that designation? I can understand that if they find an actual criminal who needs to be deported and he or she is with a group of other people who are also undocumented but who are not criminals, I understand that you may find them all together in one place, but why would you waste your time and money with those people who are not criminals? Even aside from whether or not it's right or wrong, you don't have time for them. Why are you wasting government time and money on that?
I mean, the chaos of the point. I think everyone would agree that we want violent criminals to be sent back. I think everybody's in agreement on that. I don't think anyone is in disagreement with that. If they are, wow. It's the mass get them all out that, as Austin kind of illustrated, creates some issues here. The paranoia, the fear. It's been a tough week for the city of Chicago and the nation. And I feel for the communities, the families, and people should pay attention to the fact that when Trump and his allies are saying all immigrants, all illegal immigrants, specifically they're talking about Latinos. They are not talking about Ukrainians. They're not talking about Russians. They're not talking about European illegal immigrants. They are talking about Latinos. It's a dog whistle. It's intentional. It's clear. At this point, enough people are talking about it. Now we got to look at what is the opposition party going to do about it. The words are abundant. The tweets are abundant. But if the opposition party has nothing but thoughts and prayers and spicy catchphrases, then the cruelty is going to continue. And that's all she wrote.
If you are maybe in civil breach of the law, if you aren't supposed to be here and you're here, that's pretty much all the argument plenty of people need for saying that you as an individual, we can't get 17 million of them on those planes, but too bad for you. We didn't get them all, but we got you, and you should not be here. And there are, I heard from somebody today, they said, my kids and their friends are from Mexico, but they came here legally, and they don't want these people who aren't going through proper channels. So I understand the sort of disparity of crimes we're talking about, but at the end of the day, those people shouldn't be here. So why do we have sympathy for people who should not be here? And I know it's because they're good pillars of the community and they do jobs and all that, but technically they're in violation of the law. That's the end of the argument for a lot of people. That's where they throw up their hands and say, what's the matter with you people? What part of in violation of the law don't you understand?
But are the kids of these illegal immigrants in violation of the law as well? And that's where we talk about, we need empathy and humanity here. You know, you have kids talking about they're scared to go home and their parent may not be there. Like, that's real. And that's not cool. Like, it shouldn't be a partisan thing to say that is inhumane. That is cruel.
Well, do you think that the city and county should cooperate more if somebody without a federal warrant but is being held in Cook County and is without proper documentation here, should we just purge the county lockup with those people? Tom Dart's not doing that. They're specifically not cooperating.
I, for one, would say, yeah, I did not vote for specifics of our sanctuary city status. And I personally think that we should be cooperating with ICE, that our police should cooperate with ICE when we have actual criminals who are wanted by ICE.
And they have a warrant.
Accusations against them. It should not be impossible to have some nuance in that sanctuary city declaration, which none of us ever voted on.
I totally agree with Kate. I think and this was such an odd thing, actually, in that same press conference I was talking about, because there are questions to Commander Snelling about this. And he said, yes, we don't cooperate with ICE, but we're in constant communication. And it's like, well, what does that mean?
What are you talking about?
We're already talking to them, you know.
Yeah.
And there is a specific pointed question about, you know, and this was the I will say, I mean, Trump is a man of the television, and there's a reason why Dr. Phil is the only guy who's been giving this like, you know, 90s television cop style live streaming of what's going on.
He's
and
embedded.
Embedded, Dr. Phil embedded.
So crazy.
And the one person they picked up is someone who, you know, was convicted of a sex crime against a minor. And I mean, it's so like idiocracy to just even see like Dr. Phil talking to this person and like Tom Homan is there. It's like so insane. But to an average person seeing that, they're thinking, why did it take ICE to get this guy? I mean, he's just sort of like coming back from the store to wherever he's living in the city of Chicago. And the reporter asked the mayor that. He said, you know, why can't the city be doing that? And he said that that's the federal government's job. And I don't think that's a good answer.
I don't either.
I think Brandon's point about the opposition party, that there needs to be a better answer than that.
That guy used to be in custody. And instead of handing him over to ICE, they let him go. And if instead they handed the criminals over to ICE, there would be a whole lot less need for ICE to be in the community disrupting everything.
But I think that guy, you say they let him go. I think he was released upon completion of his sentence. So he wasn't on the lam. I think that guy had committed a crime, had mm-hmm. been prosecuted and served time for it. Maybe he was on probation. And now the federal government would love to deport that guy. Suppose you have gone through the criminal justice system in the state of Illinois. Are you branded for life with that? Are you still then a sort of person that we will turn over to the federal government, where the other person who's here just on DACA or lapsed DACA, we're not going to cooperate with? Don't ask me how to score that, but I think that's the challenge for the city, the state, and the federal government without an overlapping policy.
I think the challenge here, too, is how we view immigration in this country. Are we saying we don't want immigration at all? Are we completely hardlining against people coming here and being productive in society? Or are we open to pathways to citizenship? These people who have made a civil offense with being illegally in their status, can we create more opportunity and make the process simpler for them to actually be a citizen? I think there's many that want to be citizens of the United States. The process is just so daunting and challenging. It's just not as easy as just, you know, signing up on a sheet.
Boy, isn't that the truth? That's something we haven't talked about this week or last week and might not talk about for a while, but where this conversation is all about, how are we going to find these people? Which ones are we going to find? How are we going to get rid of them? I know, let's not do that at all. Let's just patriate these people somehow. Let's completely validate their existence and make them tax-paying customers. A lot of them are paying taxes anyway, but you get my point. The fact that Dr. Phil was there was such a head spin, so on brand. And that was, I haven't heard from Dr. Phil in a long time. I didn't know he had a TV network and that he had a live stream of this thing.
If you have DirecTV, I think Merritt Street.
That's
is
it, one Merritt Street.
Channel that you could find it. I watched a little bit of it when I was home for Christmas.
I didn't. Keep going.
It's what you would expect. You got some Dr. Phil reruns. You have reruns and a lot of those, like, you know, reality TV, chasing the bad guy shows. And then you have, like, a morning news show called Morning on Merritt Street from Sanshawn Singer, former Indianapolis anchor. It's a weird mix. I have some friends that have been offered jobs at Merritt Street based in Dallas. The whole message is obviously anti-DEI. And everyone, you know, just with their bootstraps, just every man for himself in that way. And so, yeah, that's his network. I don't know how it's doing, but I'm sure that got him a few ratings, his little charade there.
Yeah, no kidding. You remember when OAN popped during the Trump administration when he got mad at Fox News. And incidentally, what do you guys think of expanding the scope of the press room for the new White House press briefings? Now we've got podcasters or representatives from various podcasts, et cetera. I will tell you that in general, I think if people have an audience, and some of these people have 100, they got more than we got, then I don't want to knee-jerk exclude them just because they're not CBS and NBC. I have no idea how to figure out who should be in that room right now.
I think it's a great idea. When I watched the press conference, I'm like, that should be the goal for every press room, is to expand access. I was surprised to hear places like Axios had not been given access in the past. Like, that Axios is very reputable. So, you know, if we're going to get more of those in, great. What I think is going to be bad, though, I don't know if you all have been to a Trump press conference before. I had the privilege of attending one at the RNC, a Trump team press conference. And what they do is they bring in a lot of journalists and press journalists, quotation marks, who speak in talking points and ask questions in talking points and feed the answer in a sense. Like, great example. You know, Congressman, why is the left so crooked? What, the crooked left continues to rain down, you know, disparaging things on us. Why do they do that to us? And how are you going to work with the hardworking Americans and patriots of the Trump administration to get it done? Like, that's not a question. That is.
Wow.
So at this point, you know, I just think expanding access is great, but who you select matters. And I don't trust this White House to choose reputable newsmaker journalists.
It's too bad. It would be great to really open it up there. When you think about it, get it way beyond just the people who are going to the Washington Correspondents' Dinner and need to suck up to all their sources in the White House. Right. That would be fabulous. But are they necessarily going to give the new credentials to anybody we would really love to hear question Trump or his press secretary? Probably not. But at the same time, they should do it anyway. You know, get a start on that, because it definitely doesn't make any sense at this point in time to just keep it to the so-called legacy media. It doesn't cost much just to give a few credentials. I remember when I was covering City Hall for the Reader, they would not give me a desk in the press room, even though there was plenty of room. They could have given me a desk. But, you know, the Reader, just like too crazy and out there. But I could still have the credentials. They would still hand out the credentials, is my point. They don't have to give everybody a desk in the White House press room in order to allow more diversity into the actual press conferences.
One of the questions put to Carolyn Leavitt today was, are we in violation of the fire code? Because I guess they had so many people crammed in there, accommodating some of these new faces. It seems to me like the first Trump administration was going to use Zoom and let some people Zoom in with their questions, which is in the room and not in the room. That's still the kids' table, but at least you got a chance to ask some questions.
I think that room is kind of increasingly irrelevant in some ways, because the administration and folks in it are going to continue the entire strategy ahead of the election of just going straight to where these audiences are, which are listening to long-form podcasts and listening to these content creators. So I think they will continue to use those to their advantage, and it will be similar. Those people will be the ones in that, you know, special chair from new media, the new media chairs, as they're calling it. It will be folks from that world. I do think it's great to have more questions. And to Brandon's point, I'm always shocked, and I commend the Brandon Johnson's administration for letting William Kelly come in and do like these crazy, you know, soliloquies about, you know, people are telling me that you're horrible and you're just word salad and that this is just PR and you hate Chicagoans and you love illegals and there's no question. And Brandon Johnson will look at that man and he'll be saying stuff about Brandon Johnson's wife and just like spouting off.
Is this a journalist? Who is this guy?
He's a citizen journalist, but he is like, he's like the George Blakemore of the media. And I kudos to them for letting him into these press conferences and letting him ask a question every time, because they're not even questions. They're just attacking the mayor.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. It's that William Kelly's the perfect example of who I'm talking about. I'm scared the White House is going to let in these people that grandstand and give their little tweet. They read out their tweets, basically, yeah, and then try to act like it's a question. The reality is, one thing that's bipartisan is closing off media access and saying you're going to give media access and you don't really. So we'll see if they actually follow on this. That's the other thing. I'm not even sure they're actually going to do it. They created the website. You're welcome to apply.
Oh.
They said. But do they have to grant you the credential? I mean, that becomes a whole different scenario. Yeah, you could apply. Go for it. I could apply.
By the way, Producer P, while we've been doing this, just handed me two things, which here we are now at about 3:30 on Wednesday afternoon, our breaking news, and will be dated maybe as soon as some of you hear this, but I'll mention it. First of all, the one guy who is happy to have all of this RFK Jr. news and Donald Trump news is Senator Bob Menendez, because he fell out of the news, and today he was sentenced to 11 years in prison. His team asked for 27 months. He's going to go to jail for 11 years. And I don't think you get day-to-day in federal prison, right? You don't get he's not going to get out in 5.5 years, I don't think. A Democrat senator from New Jersey, who I believe is the only U.S. senator ever convicted of acting as an agent for a foreign government, is going to go to jail for 11 years. And Jason Meisner has just posted the jury in the Michael Madigan corruption trial has been sent back to begin deliberations after a marathon 16-week case. So surely we'll be talking more about this next week. Before reaching a verdict, the 8-woman, 4-man panel will have to work through a 23-count indictment and hundreds of pages of instructions, says Jason Meisner. Now we wait. Wonder what the jury's going to say. I'm going to guess that they're going to find him not guilty.
Ooh.
It's not as good as the Burke stuff. And you only need one, right? I'm going to look like a genius if I'm right on this.
Man, it's a case I haven't read that much into, but I'm going to just throw guilty out there.
I got burned on Alderman Burke. I did think he had a little bit of a chance of getting off, maybe because I got too into the weeds in keeping up with that case. So I may be overacting in the other direction, but I kind of think that Madigan's going to get convicted.
Going to jail.
Even though I did appreciate, as I said a while back, I appreciated his South Side accent. And when he testified, and I appreciated him patronizing his South Side restaurants.
You are so kicked off the jury, lady. There's no way.
I totally would have been. Even though I appreciated those things, and I do think he acquitted himself incredibly well on the stand, nonetheless.
Here it comes.
They have gotten quite a bit of evidence up there against him that I just don't see him
he
getting.
So
back.
Charming. Austin, you more than anybody, you've written a book on this guy or done a documentary. What about it?
I think he will be guilty. They got Burke, the ComEd four, Mapes, his number two guy, McLean, his other number two guy, turned on him. This would be his greatest, you know, political achievement of his life. If yes, he
and he's had a few. Let's close with our red light, yellow light, green light. Austin, you go first. What are you recommending or not?
Green light on this book. This is a biography of Thelonious Monk that I'm reading right now. It's really good. It's called Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original. Biggest selling point is something you learn on literally the second page of the book. This is one of the craziest stories I've ever heard. Thelonious Monk's in New York, grown up, born and raised in Manhattan, pianist, arranger. There's another guy also in New York, also a jazz musician, same time, named Julius Monk. And they would have known each other. Their names were like next to each other in the phone book of the jazz musicians. And late in life, Julius Monk realized that Julius Monk's great-grandfather was the slave owner of Thelonious Monk's great-grandfather in North Carolina. And that's why he had the name Monk. And they were both jazz musicians in Manhattan at the same time. So it's a crazy book. Wow. And I really recommend it.
One guy's white, one guy's black, I guess, huh?
Yes.
Wow.
That's astonishing.
Crazy story.
All right. Brandon, you're going to have to figure me on this. You recommended Black Duck.
Yeah.
A while back.
Yeah.
And I'm a big Keira Knightley fan, and I'm a big fan of the actor whose name escapes me, who is kind of her partner in the spy agency.
Ben Whishaw.
Okay. He was incredible in one of the seasons of Fargo. I was just finishing it up this week, and
I'm a yellow.
Yellow light, not a red light.
I'm a yellow on this,
yellow
too.
Yellow ones.
Black Dove.
Still love my Keira Knightley. Still love that actor. All right, here's my problem with that show. I'm wondering what you think about this. Okay, they belong to a spy agency, but I could never have any kind of sympathy for Keira Knightley. As much as I love her, because she's working for a spy agency with no morals. She's not trying to help her country. You find out this right away in the very beginning. So I'm not giving anything away, that she has signed up to a spy agency where she's like, oh, am I going to betray my country? Yeah, maybe. Oh, well, okay. Why not? So I could just, you know, and I thought, well, it's Keira Knightley. I'll keep watching. I'm gonna get into it and feel for her character, and no matter how crazy the plot gets, and you know what? You were right. The twists and the turns of the plot. That I recommend that. There's one in particular that I really enjoyed. But I have just never gotten past not being able to have any sympathy for the main characters because of the fact that they're working for this completely amoral spy agency.
Very fair. Completely understand that. Oh. Well, maybe you guys won't like the next green light then. Maybe my track record may not be so good, but I'm going to give a green light on a new show called Paradise, just dropped on Hulu. And Disney's putting a big push behind this. They simulcast on ABC. Scott Sterling K. Brown, it's from the creator of This Is Us. And if you remember This Is Us, which was very sappy and emotional, it's not like that. This is a political thriller. It's about a bodyguard for a president, and the president ends up dead. And so the mystery is, what happened to the president? And is there a conspiracy around that? And there's a twist that happens in the first episode. I will not reveal it. Just like This Is Us and their pilot, there was a twist that really flips on its head what the whole show was about. So if you want a good, twisty, political thriller, Paradise on Hulu.
My green light is going to be the I've got a stack of books and I'm always reading them. So sometimes I recommend things too much because I've been reading it for months. But the Cher memoirs still on my table, and I'm still enjoying that. And it is such a dysfunctional relationship she has with Sonny, because she starts living with him when she's 16 or 17 years old. He's about 9 years older than her, and he, realizing that she's a star, uses her. And as much as you see Cher as sort of this outrageous, strident, bold lady, she was just a teenage kid under his wing, and he so manipulated her, and he so robbed from her, and he so lied and cheated on her, and she kept coming back. And that just doesn't sound like Cher. But the story of them going from riches to poverty, and then now it's the Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour on CBS, is a roller coaster. It's really fun. Makes me want to go back and watch some of the old episodes, which I've been doing. So I'm all about Cher this week, and I'm green lighting her memoir, Cher. And
well, I'm glad he skied into a tree. Didn't he ski into a tree?
He did, and we aren't to that point yet, but I'm telling you what, this is such a...
Oh, sorry, spoiler alert.
This is such an evil thought, but in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, karma's a bitch, man. Something bad's really going to happen to you, and she's going to be done with you, and it's going to be tragic, and she's going to speak with tears in her eyes at your funeral. But but there's that thing. That thing just kind of hangs over it as you read it. You know the ending for him. Okay, that's this week's podcast. Thank you, Brandon Pope and Kate Plies, Austin Berg. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Okay. All right, sounds
good. Talk next week, kids. Bye now.
Later.
Bye.
See you.
To the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.